Okay, now I'm going to bring on Jackie Jacobs. She's in Seattle. Jackie, you're there, right?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
You want me, Jackie? Now I know you and I love you, but a lot of people have not met you yet. So why don't you just tell everybody a little about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, well, I am originally from North Carolina. I currently reside in Seattle. I am a member of the Lumbee tribe. And I am from a family with five siblings total. And I am very close to my siblings. Kit and I are only 13 months apart, and then there was like a gap, and then so we have younger siblings that he and I adored and were protective over. But after college, I went overseas and ultimately followed one of my brothers out to the Pacific Northwest, the Seattle, Washington area, where I've been ever since, with the exception of taking a break for a couple years to go look for Kent. And my background here is in public relations and marketing. I have a boutique company that I started about 15 years ago.
Yeah, you actually folded up your life in Seattle to come back to Hope Mills for a couple of years to look for Kent. This is about what year was that?
Yeah, Kent disappeared in March 10th of 2002, and it's really unbelievable, Dennis, because I had just purchased my dream condo. I just was, let's see, 90 days or less into my dream job, and just really having a beautiful experience in Seattle. I was involved in a lot of philanthropic organizations, so going to a lot of charity events and, great friends, going to fabulous restaurants and having great food, and just talking about how what change we can make for the better for society. And then March 10th, my world blew up when my brother was abducted, disappeared, vanished. So I sold my home and resigned from that job and went back to our small town in North Carolina to look for my brother and to be there to support my mom and my siblings.
Yeah, that's Hope Mills, which is right outside of Fayetteville. And for the people who don't know, can you just tell them a little bit about Kent and what kind of a person he was?
Oh, yeah. Well, Kent is the firstborn of the siblings. Kent was born with mental retardation, and as I mentioned earlier, we're 13 months apart. And there's different levels of mental retardation. So just a quick education for the listeners, there is mild and then moderate, severe, and profound. And I would say that and basically what that means is there's a delay in cognitive abilities and social and motor skills at those different levels. And I would say for Kent that he would lean between the moderate to severe. His symptoms weren't, his diagnosis wasn't mild and it wasn't profound. Profound are those people who are probably immobile and need 24-hour care. Mild are like the educable, mentally retarded, where they can actually go to school and go to a classroom. Moderate is like Kent could dress himself, he could feed himself, but he probably could not stay by himself. But he was also very bright and very funny. So if I were to give you an age, there are times where he vacillated between a 7-year-old to a 9-year-old.
Okay, but he was 41 when he disappeared, so that just gives people a little perspective.
Yeah, he was chronologically 41, and then had the the mind. He was like a child mentally.
Hey, something I want to get across to the listeners, just because Kent was chronologically a child, he had a limited scope in life, but within that scope, and we were talking the other night, Jackie, Kent was probably happier than most people listening to this podcast right now, right?
Oh, yeah, Kent had a really full life. One of the things that my parents made sure of is that while we cared for Kent, Kent was very independent in his things that he enjoyed in life. And he was he was also very loyal. But back to the joy, the one thing that Kent didn't, he just loved living. It wasn't a matter of happiness or sad. Everything that he did and that he engaged in was he was profoundly joyful. He didn't go in it with intellectual biases or opinions or agendas. Whatever was in front of him at the time, he thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. And so a lot happier, to be quite honest with you, than someone with a higher intellectual capacity and cognitive ability.
Because he didn't have all that stresses in his life, right? He was just happy.
Right, right. And, you know, I always said, again, my parents were, you know, very mindful while making sure he was cared for, that he was treated equally and fairly. So things that he had interest in, they didn't limit him from exploring. Like he wanted to learn how to drive a golf cart or ride a mini bike or even tie his shoes. I'll use that as an example, you know, because I'm 13 months older, and I was able to tie my shoes sooner than Kent. And when he saw me do that, he was bound and determined to do it. Now, I tied my shoes around, I guess, age three or four. Right. And Kent finally, from that point on, finally tied his shoes at 9 years old. That means he tried every single time, every single day, multiple times a day until he was nine, and he accomplished it.
And his old man, could he shave by himself, or did he need help with that?
Yeah, Mama would have to shave him, but he could shower by himself, and you know, he was able to feed himself and that sort of thing. But he would because he also was legally blind. Oh. So he was born with cataracts.
No, I didn't know that.
And though he could see, it was only like to watch the television, he would have to be like just like a legally like right up next to like in front of it. So his distance, his ability to see distances was not very good. So when he was walking, his head was always looking down so he could see where he was going.
Okay, you said a key word there, walking. Because of his condition, he wasn't able to have a driver's license, but he was kind of well known in Hope Mills because he was that guy that was walking everywhere every day, right?
Yeah. And then back to my dad, I'll share with the listeners a really cute story. And again, Kent seeing something happen with me before it happened with him. And of course, I got my driver's permit when I was 15 and my license when I was 16. And I was just, you know, like any 16-year-old at the dinner table, very proud, showing my license. And now Kent knew he was older than I was because, you know, we always told him he was the oldest. So he looked at my dad like really confused, like, well, why don't I have one? And I'm like, 'cause you can't drive, you know, being the little pesky little, you know, little sister. Right. And I kid you not, the next day he came home and he had in his pocket a driver's license. So
where do you get that from?
I know this shows you the caliber of parents that we had raising a special needs child. My daddy took the initiative and the time to take him down to the DMV like he was really applying for his license.
Oh, you got a state ID?
No, he got a driver's license that was not valid. So he got to take his little picture. They didn't have state IDs back then, but he was just convinced because it was a voided driver's license is what it was. But they were kind enough to allow this, you know, special needs boy to come in and go through the process. And back to the walking.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't drive, of course, walking was his main mode of transportation. And when he first started walking, we would follow him, but we would pretend like, you know, like we weren't following him. So we'd let him get far enough in front of us that he didn't know we jumped in the car because we wanted to see how he navigated being on the side of the road or if he ventured into the road. And the places he was walking were places that he was very familiar with, like from one point to another is like from where we lived to where he lived when he currently disappeared to
his childhood friends.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And then after a while, we felt confident enough that he could navigate that alone. and he was able to. But again, Hope Mills is a small town, and our family, everybody knew our family there. I mean, after my daddy's passing, there's a ball field there named in honor of my daddy, because he was instrumental in getting youth athletics in the town, baseball, for example. And they named the first official field after him. So everybody knew that my daddy and my parents had a special needs son. They knew our whole family. And everybody kind of looked after Kent.
Right.
So if they saw him walking, they would kind of do the same thing, just sort of slow down and make sure he got where he was going. Or sometimes they would give him a ride. But I just want to make sure, in making that comment, that the listeners understand, Kent would not get in a car with somebody he didn't know. Like, you would have to roll down the window and just say, Kent, I would myself have to say, it's your sister, it's okay, get in. So there were several people in the neighborhood that he trusted enough that if they came by and called his name, that he would let them take him home.
Okay, now here's something important for the listeners. It's a good segue. Two of the things you talked about, we think, may have led to what happened to Kent. At first, when he was like 1 or 2 years old, you didn't realize his condition so much, and he started forming friendships in the community with the other small children in the neighborhood, and they had lifelong relationships, like the Kim Godwin and Donnie Godwin and Roger. These are people that Kent grew up with as a child. But as they got older and older and older, unfortunately, these childhood friends chose poor decisions in life and they went the drug route. But they still loved Kent as almost, they made some bad decisions and horrible decisions, but Kent was, they were loved by Kent, right?
Oh my God. Okay. So let me just clarify, because we moved to Hope Mills from the Lumberton area when I was 7 and Kent was 8. So those childhood friends, still very formative time.
Okay.
And an adolescent's childhood were formed around that age. But for Kent, it would have been like he was 2 or 3, because that would have been his cognitive ability at the time. So not only did I don't even know how to explain his love and admiration and loyalty to this group of friends, because, you know, we're second graders and third grade, we're little kids. And the reason that he got to know this core group of people is because the parents were friends of my parents. And so they would all come over and we would play together. So a lot of bonding happened when we first moved to this new area and got to meet that first set of kids. And again, I had referenced Kent's loyalty earlier. It's a testament to that, because even when he went to school, in his mind, his real friends were the ones that lived across the street and, you know, down the road and so forth and so on. And he not only loved them, he worshiped them, because he wanted to be like them, and they accepted him and they included him and they didn't ostracize him. So his heart was fuller than I can even really adequately convey. And as you mentioned, we just assumed that love, because it was reciprocal, they did take care of Kent, had continued on into adulthood. We had no idea that things had veered off the way they had with their choices in life.
Okay, now at some point your family moved, but not too far, maybe 2 or 3 miles away to where your mom is now. And that's where Kent would walk on his daily routines. He would walk from where you'd moved over to his old neighborhood where all his friends were.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a pretty, you know, it's a straightforward route. It's like you take 2 lefts and you get there or something like that, right?
But yeah, it was
and
about a half hour walk there, right?
Yeah, about a half hour walk. But like I said, initially, because we were still in high school when we moved to the location where my mom lived when Kent disappeared, that again, those just seeing it went from him seeing his friends every day, being able to come home from after school, change into his play clothes and go visit his friends, to, you know, he just was lonely and would ask permission to go. And for the first few years after we moved, we just drove him ourselves every single time, several times a week. And then ultimately it was so cute, because when he turned 18, he's like, I'm an adult now.
Yeah.
And you wanted to just sort of be always mindful of, like I said, respecting that and trying to allow him to embrace his independence while at the same time knowing that, you know, we still have to look out for him.
Okay, Jackie, speak to his independence. I want people to know that Kent would always work. So from like 18 to 41, what kind of jobs was he doing? What was he doing on when he was 41 when he disappeared?
Well, Kent had a variety of jobs his whole life. Like you said, you know, not only was that important to our parents, it was important to Kent, because if he saw me doing something, he wanted to do it. And, you know, I got my first job at 15 as a server at Pizza Hut, and he was ready to get a job. You know, he wanted a Pizza Hut hat. So my parents found accessible jobs that he would be able to do. So throughout the years, they had partnered with different special needs organizations in the county where we were from that would place adults with diminished mental capacity and special needs in certain environments. And that could be anything from janitorial to helping sort nuts and bolts in a warehouse. I mean, he actually had at one point worked in the janitorial services at the state line between North Carolina and South Carolina.
The rest stops there?
Yeah, the rest stop at the south of the border, yeah. Like the state line. And the organization, of course, was responsible for transporting and bringing him home and that sort of thing. And then we lost my father when I was 21 and Kent was 22. And at that point, his care became... my mom had to work full time because she had, you know, four children at home. Whereas with dad, they were a team. And so she had to go into full time employment, which meant Kent would just be by himself most of the day. So long story short, we found a group home that catered to adults who were also looking to be independent and would also be able to provide transportation back and forth from their employment. And so he worked all his life, earned his own money, would save up to buy things that he wanted, just like, you know, every other teenager, every other adult, and got paid like every other week. And some of the things.
That's where things kind of took a turn. So explain, Kent used to take his money and give it to his mom when he got his check, right? And then your mom would give him like a $20 bill to spend. And she would save.
Yeah, she would save all his money for him, and all his money being like every 2 weeks, he'd get a couple of $100s because, you know, being special needs, they were paid at, you know, wages some less than $1 an hour, if you will. But he was very proud of that money. And so when they would go to cash his check, my mom and Kent had a ritual where they'd go through the drive-through. She'd give them the check, excuse me, and get the cash. And she would let Kent hold every single dollar he earned. And and then she would take it all back, except an allowance of mainly $20, sometimes 40. She would keep 40, but for later on. And so he was very frugal. And so he saved his money. And this particular weekend.
Right. Now we're going to transition into the day that Kent disappeared, which is March 10th of 2002, 18 years ago. And one of the things that we believe led to Kent's disappearance was your mom and Kent, they missed getting up that day, right?
Missed getting up as far as
Kent giving the check to your mom.
Oh, I see. So they went to the bank that weekend. Okay. Before the 10th. And that particular weekend, that particular weekend, my mom did not get all his money back that weekend. And she got home and, you know, he's so proud. He had it laid out on the bed and she just, you know, watched him, you know, enjoy looking at the money he had earned, because he'd never been able to keep that much before.
It was about $200, right? $200?
Yeah, $200 in $20 bills. And so their weekend went pretty much as normal. And Sunday, my mother goes to church every Sunday, and she got up that particular Sunday, which would have been March 10th. and told Kent she would see him after church. And that was one of the days that it was normal for him to go visit. And he always knew that he had to be back at 5 o'clock because he needed to go back to his group home for work the next day. And we also had a ritual where I would call him at 12 o'clock my time. I actually was working in a marketing position with a real estate company at the time. And I would call him during my lunch. So he was usually home between 3 and 5 is my point in sharing that. My mom would leave about 9:30 in the morning for church. So his visitation would be, you know, anywhere from 10 to 11 to the early afternoon, but never past 5.
So on the day he disappeared, March 10th, you're actually 3,000 miles away in Seattle, right?
Yeah.
Can you walk us through how that your life unfolded on that day and going forward?
Sure.
How did you find out about it?
Well, I normally, again, I'd just gotten my dream job, and I normally didn't work on Sundays, but because I was the marketing director for this, it was Seattle's very first $100 million high-rise, and if you can imagine a number of that magnitude in 2002, right? We've not seen a project of that magnitude here before, so I was just in heaven. I owned my dream home across the street from where I worked, and so I got up and I went to work, and we had a really, really full day. And I did take a break to make the call at 12, which would have been 3 o'clock North Carolina time, and there was no answer. And at first I got a little bit of a twinge in my stomach, and I just thought, but I didn't really think that much of it. So I went back and finished my work, and about 5 o'clock I was finished, and I called my mom, which would have been 8 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, I called my mom, which would have been 8 o'clock their time. And her voice immediately was different. It's just in the hello. And so she said hello. And instead of saying hello, I immediately said, "What's wrong?" And just in this, I don't even know how to explain the tone, Dennis. It was just void of any, she just was like, "Kent's not home." And the minute I heard those words, I knew in my heart and soul my family was in for a tragedy. And I know that may seem extreme to the listeners hearing that, because it did seem extreme even to my immediate siblings when I said that. But I, you know, again, I'm 13 months younger than Kent. We had a bond that is indescribable. I knew him on levels as a sibling that siblings that close would probably know each other and beyond. He would never, and especially special needs people to begin with, he would never step out of his comfort zone and not coming his routine and coming home. He would not want to get in trouble. He just would not have made any of the choices that resulted in him not coming home by 8 p.m. And so I called my, and I immediately said, "Mom," because I was trying to stay calm for her. And I said, "What are you doing?" And my mama, if you can imagine a den that was converted from a carport, there were a couple stairs that led down into our den. She was sitting on the stairs, looking at the door, waiting for him to walk through the door. And so I knew she was in a state of shock. And I said to her, she needed to hang up, find a picture of Kent, and call the police. And mom's response going into a very was protective, confused state was, why? Because if she needed to call the police, that meant something was wrong. And she didn't believe or want to believe anything was wrong. And I said, "You've got to call the police." And it just so happened one of our childhood friends that lived across the street was a member of the Cumberland County Sheriff's Office at the same time. And I said, "And after that, you need to contact this
Heath.
Person that lived across the street." Yeah.
That was Heath, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Heath McDonald. And then I reached out to my siblings and I said, we have a situation, and explained that Kent wasn't home. And again, trying to just be as positive and not overreact. They're like, "I'm sure he's going to be home in the morning and it's going to be asleep in the backseat of your mom's car." And I'm like, no, he's not. And I didn't want to make any more statements at that moment, because again, I knew what my head, my heart, and my gut was telling me. Excuse me. And then I told them at the time, I'll make arrangements to be on the red eye flight that night, which I did. And from there, you know,
you flew home that night. You flew home that very night.
Wow. I took a red eye. Yeah. And, the police came, and, you know, my sister and her husband came in, and, my sister met me at the airport. I went to the airport, of course, couldn't sleep on the plane, walked into my mother's den, gave her a hug and a kiss, and from literally turned around and went to the sheriff's department. But I'll tell you, when I flew into the small regional airport of the Fayetteville Regional Airport in the area that we lived, and I said to my sister, where are all the cameras? Where's the media? Because I had only seen or known of missing person cases in movies, right? And you always see the media everywhere. And my sister worked in television at the time, and she looked at me and she said, Sis, I want to tell you something. And I was like, what? And, you know, and she goes, the media is not going to cover this story. And I looked at her and I said, why not? I said, how can we find a missing person if nobody knows he's missing? And she goes, and this is having to come from the baby sister of an older brother that she loves and adores. And she goes, because he's a middle-aged man, he's a minority Native American, and he has mental retardation.
And she knew that from the first minute.
She knew from the very second.
Boy, was she right.
And she was absolutely, she goes, we've already struck out. And take any of those alone.
I never knew that, Jackie.
Oh, yeah, those were the first words. That's exactly, because I was like, I literally was like, where are the cameras? I thought I was going to come into that, again, like you see in the movies or you see now on television when you have high profile missing cases. And she looked at me and I was just gutted. And on the way to the sheriff's department, I went, how are we going to find him if people don't know? And at that point, we had asked the sheriff's department to reach out to the Fayetteville Observer. So the Fayetteville Observer, and I'll get back to the sheriff's department in a minute, ran a story the following day, which would have been March 12th. And it was just like... I can't even remember. It was just the very benign. There was no picture, and it was like missing man in Hope Mills or something like that. But there was no picture. And I'm like, how can you find a person with no picture? And the sheriff's department had made the decision in that conversation with the newspaper not to identify Ken as mentally retarded because they thought that would scare the community. So they made an error and said he had Down syndrome. Well, children and adults with Down syndrome have very specific features that do not correlate with someone with mental retardation. I said, they're going to be looking for someone with Down syndrome features, not someone with mental retardation features, because usually with mental retardation, your forehead, your brain might protrude a little bit forward. They just thought that they would be frightened by seeing Kent's picture. And if you see pictures of my brother was always so very happy in his pictures. Yeah. His spirit would just shine through. And
I could stop you there. We have a corresponding website. It's a Kristen, KRISTEN for Kristen Modafferi and Kent. And you could see Kent's photographs, and I'll have a picture of Jackie up there as well at the KristenandKent.com website. For the listeners that don't know much about the case yet, because Kent hasn't been found and no arrest, you know, we can't say for certain exactly what happened, but I'll speak to this and Jackie, you can take over. What happened, in my opinion, is, remember those childhood friends that Kent had growing up? Well, when, you know, a lot of people grow up, they end up going to college and everything. Well, these childhood friends of Kent, when they grew up, I hate to say it, but they made really, really bad, bad life decisions, a lot of drugs and rap sheets a mile long, but they still loved Kent. And Kent, with his limited capacity, these were still the friends that he grew up with. He didn't understand the lifestyle they were living. And we have a feeling that they found out, well, we know for a fact that they found out that Kent had that $200 on him. We'll talk about, I'll interview Belinda Hall. She's one of the drug dealers that actually came forth and told us the truth about what happened to that day when all the other people were lying. And we have the knowledge of what happened, well, may have happened in large part because of Belinda Hall. But Jackie, your version of that, can you explain it from your point of view?
Yeah, well, let me jump back into going to the sheriff's department for the first time, because it just so happened that the person who was head of major crimes, which is where a missing person is categorized at the time, went to high school with us. Again, this is a small town, so everybody knows everybody. And he looked at me and he says, well, you know, maybe Kent just jumped on the back of a bike or got in a car and went to the beach. And I just was astounded at that comment, because again, Kent wouldn't get in a stranger in a car with a stranger ever. And I was trying to get them to understand that the magnitude of what we were dealing with was not as benign as they were making it seem. Like, you know, he'll be home in a week after bike week. That was just absurd. So I thought, if they're going into it with that mindset, we're going to lose precious time and precious hours without it being taken that seriously. And then I'll just go ahead and share that we were then, my sister and I were introduced to a Detective Davenport who had been assigned my brother's case. And
now, this is
my
sister Kimberly, right?
My sister Kimberly, my right. Only sister.
Okay.
And again, so wise, like you mentioned with her comment to me at the airport. We weren't even down the steps after the meeting with the sheriff's department. We were still on the steps of the sheriff's department. And she looked at me and she goes, if that's the person, referencing Detective Davenport, that is responsible for finding our brother, we'll never find him. She just picked up immediately on her incompetence, her lack of analytical skills, her lack of human relations skills.
But Jackie, and how do you, I mean, a pushback on that, how do you think she got that job if she's that weak in her job skill abilities?
You know, I can't speak to that, Dennis, but I can say that, and we were never able to get to the bottom of it. She was dismissed during the course of Kent's initial investigation. I tried to get answers as to why. I heard rumors that it was for, you know, mental or emotional reasons or whatever, but I know that she was not a competent detective.
Oh, okay.
And I'll share with, from there, we basically turned into detectives ourselves. We went into the community and started asking questions and would call her with leads and tips, and she'd go, oh, well, we don't want to follow up on right now. It's a ghost lead. Or she just was constantly dismissing fresh information that we were getting that people would probably tell us more so than they would tell the police. So after repeated the first few days, you know, hours that turned to days that turned to weeks with her not acknowledging that, you know, we've got, you know, four siblings and a brother-in-law out in the community every day asking questions, for those to just be constantly dismissed was just very, very, very frustrating.
Yeah, you know, one thing I want people to know out there, I mean, God forbid, I hope this never happens to you, but if you have a family member go missing, you need to know right away, as well-meaning as police officers are, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, they're the most well-meaning, they are swamped with caseloads, and to think that they're going to devote 100% of time to your missing child, you're crazy. So I always think you got to report it to the police right away, but I would never hand 100% responsibility over to finding your child to a law enforcement agency, only because they don't have the time, and they'll never look you in the eye and say, we don't have the time, you know? And
right.
So the way your family went out at that first week, that's the way to do it. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. We were, because listen, you're also thrust into the biggest nightmare of your life. You know, we couldn't eat. It was so hard to go to sleep at night, thinking when it got dark, that was the worst.
This too personal? Do you mind sharing what? Because a lot of people, I mean, I've been around your family and the Smarts, the Chris Smart of San Luis Obispo and the Mataferi family out of Charlotte. But I still don't know the internal hell that somebody in your position goes through. Is that too emotional for you to talk about?
Well, I can speak to my experience, because I, through the process, have learned that, you know, my mom had and has her own journey, as do my individual siblings. But again, you can't even process what is happening. You're vacillating between a state of shock, a state of confusion, a state of heartbreak, a state of anger, a state of helplessness. And so energetically, your whole body is experiencing that as well. I mean, you can't, you know, it's like when you hear shocking news that's not of that magnitude, you just immediately cave in the center. Your stomach is in knots. Trying to go to sleep at night was unbearable because you didn't know how to turn off the fear of him being out there somewhere in the dark, afraid, alone, cold, hungry,
calling out your name, right?
Calling us, and then hearing my mom literally would have primal wails of crying and tears at night. Just she cried all night. Every night.
One of the reasons I'm doing this podcast, there may be somebody out there with information. And after hearing what Jackie just shared with you, you have the opportunity right now to do the right thing. Just please consider doing the right thing. It's 18 years for Kent. So Jackie, how do you even begin? At some point, you got to get back on that plane back to Seattle, right? And how do you even function?
Well, I'll just share with the listeners that first week was excruciating and the pain only intensified. But that first week, Kent turned his birthday. Well, he was abducted a week before his 42nd birthday. So what we were going to do
March 16th is his birthday, right?
Yeah.
And he disappeared on the 10th. Yeah.
So we were planning a huge birthday celebration for him because listen, for Kent, his birthday was more joyful and important to him than Christmas. And he loved his birthday because it was just his special day. Kent would start reminding you of his birthday the day after his birthday.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd be like, he goes, you know, my birthday's coming up. I was like, dude, your birthday was yesterday. So it was always a big deal in our family. And he was so excited about his birthday. So instead of having that party, we had the biggest search in the history of our county that day. And I'll never forget when the detectives came in, it was supposed to go into a couple more days. But after the first day, they said, we need to call off this search. Now, again, these are people in the water, above the, you know, in the air, in the woods, and just, you know, we had special forces soldiers. We did have an amazing turnout for that search, members of the Cotton Volunteer Fire Department. And he goes, we're not going to find him. And I was like, what? We just started, you know, please let's not give up. I just felt that was just quitting too soon. But it was during the announcement with the sheriff, we had a member of the sheriff's department in our house making that announcement, that we got a call that my mom's mom, technically her sister, but her sister raised her, was in the ER at the hospital about 30 to 40 miles away, about on her lap, like she was dying. And that came out of nowhere. So my auntie died 1 minute after midnight on Kent's birthday. So in the middle of the biggest tragedy of our lives, this woman who's the matriarch on my mom's side, the person she considered her sister who raised her since she was one, the person that I would go sit at the feet of and the knees of for wisdom and love and courage, had passed away. So 2 weeks into Kent's disappearance, we now had a funeral to attend. So we were sitting in the pew.
I never knew that, Jackie. I never knew that.
Yeah. So we couldn't even process that loss because it was like somebody had already hit us upside the head with a bat on one side of our head. And then that news just hit us on the other. So we were comatose. And what would have been, you know, an opportunity of mourning and grieving and you know, sharing the love and loss and celebration of my aunt's life, we literally couldn't, the Jacobs family was sitting there like zombies. It was too much. So back And I share that to say that the second week of Kent's disappearance was also about preparing for the funeral of this matriarch. So I got on the plane at the conclusion of that 2 weeks, because again, being responsible for this $100 million high rise, they're like, okay, yeah, you know, we're sorry and we feel for you. And then after 2 weeks, they're like, hey, you need to come back to work. It was really that cold. As a matter of fact, they FedExed me. I got a FedEx letter from the corporation that said if I wasn't back in 2 weeks, that they would have to replace me.
Wow. I never knew that either. I got to interview you more, Jackie. I'm learning a lot.
So you add that. And plus, then that had ripped the joy out of the, you know, story I had told myself about this corporation that was so caring and so, you know, supportive and just so kind at the commencement of this, you know, again, unthinkable news of my brother's abduction, to finally it just came back to, hey, we're sorry that happened to you and all, but we have to have you here or we'll replace you. So I didn't even get an additional 2 weeks that I would have gotten during the loss of like a family member, like my you know, auntie Grant / grandmother. So I come back to Seattle again, gutted. I don't even know how to explain the physical feeling to the listeners, just other than if you can feel somebody ripping out your insides, your heart, your stomach, your guts. I just was that hollow. I was just a shell of a person, and had to immediately go to a corporate job for 8 hours a day. So back then we didn't have, you know, social media like we have today. And I would just come home and from 5, 6 o'clock at night until 2 and 3 in the morning, just research everything I could on missing persons. And I came across this girl's name of Kristen Mottaferri and a Kristen Smart, along with the guy named Ron Hall, who had done a website for this Mottaferri girl. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, you know, my name is Jackie Jacobs. My brother is missing. I don't know what to do. I was wondering if you could help us put up a website, if you could tell me how much it would cost. And that was Ron Hall, who, like you, to this, you know, this 18 years later is like family. And I went to bed for a few hours and I woke up the next morning and he put up a basic website for Kent, which to me, Dennis, was like the biggest thing in the world.
Right.
Like, I can't even tell you. And then I saw that this Kristen Mottaferri girl had, you know, her dad, Bob. I called him in North Carolina because Kristen Mottaferri was from North Carolina. And I was just like, there's somebody that knows what we were going through. And I had a brief conversation with Mr. Mottaferri. And from that, continuing to research her, I found the name Dennis Mann.
So that's how we met, yeah.
And that's how we met, because I reached out to you and said, can you help us? Can you help me? I don't know what to do, because the other thing I want the listeners to understand is while I'm researching organizations for help, because Kent was, again, chronologically 41, we didn't get any services from the missing center, the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, because Kent was too old, even though as a child, it would be like going out to look for a 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 year old. They're like, our guidelines prohibit us from helping you. So we didn't get any of that support.
Hey, Jackie, I know another story about, listen to this, in the Mottaferri case. Kristen Mottaferri, she disappeared 23 days after turning 18. So she also didn't qualify. And Debbie, mm-hmm. Listen to this. Debbie Mottaferri was going out of her mind.
Yeah.
Calling that group saying, you got to help my child.
Yeah.
And guess they wouldn't help her. And guess what? The phone rings one day. You ready for this? It was that organization calling for Mrs. Mottaferri, asking for a donation.
Of course. Yeah. Well, and out of that, out of the Kristen, again, a few weeks having turned 18, the people with diminished mental capacity like Kent, elderly people getting, you know, abducted and disappearing, as you and I both know, from that came the silver alert. And so, but at the beginning, again, for families like myself and the Mottaferris, there was zero help, zero.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And for the listeners just getting into it, going forward, the podcast that I plan on doing, it's all you're going to get a deep dive education into all the particular players and what we think happened, some of the theories. And the biggest one, I'll keep talking about it. There's a search warrant out there that says that Detective Trogdon, a really, really great detective for the Fayetteville Sheriff's Department, Cumberland County, in the search warrant, Jackie says, you know, there is probable cause to believe that the human remains of your brother Kent are buried in a refrigerator located on Gregory Leonard Jones's property in Hope Mills. Now, Gregory's not a suspect. He happened to own the property at the time that the search warrant was written. But the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department, they really believe that one of the places where your brother may be is located on the property. And that search warrant was in 2010. Here we are 10 years after that, and that refrigerator still has not been dug up. So we're going to talk about that going forward. But Jackie, at this point, 18 years, besides the refrigerator, we need to focus on that. What else do you think right now that we could be doing for your brother to help bring him home?
Well, it's like you alluded to earlier, Dennis, somebody out there, even with some of the key players having died, knows what happened on March 10th of 2002. And even if they've heard like a rumor or they dismiss it going, that's not possible or that's not important, every piece of information is important because it could be the missing piece that we need to solve this case. So I just ask the listeners for, you know, their support in helping us spread this, you know, story on social media, sharing this podcast, you know, getting to, because Kent's story is, it's heart-wrenching and it's gut-wrenching and it's frustrating. And I know that, you know, there are going to be a lot of questions as to why didn't this happen or that happened or why didn't you know this or how, you know, I can tell you that we have experienced every conceivable emotion there is to have in a situation like this. But we just need the support in any way that the listeners feel move to support.
Well, I have potentially good news along that line. You already know about it, but some of the listeners may not. There's a regular guy out in California, Chris Lambert's his name, and he just wanted to do something. And he's just a normal person. I mean, he doesn't have any superhuman powers, but he started a podcast on the Kristen Smart case, and it's called Your Own Backyard, if you do a search on it. But the reason I want you to focus on, Jackie, is 7 months after he put his podcast available for the public, he had over 4.2 million downloads. And the Kristen Smart case has become a sensation largely due to him. And he's gotten a lot of people calling with tips that he's given to the sheriff's department. So I don't know if we can get 4 million downloads. We probably won't hit that. But pretty much everybody in Hope Mills is going to hear your interview today and these other podcasts. And maybe somebody will give the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department a tip they need, or they can even put in a tip through our KristenandKent.com website. So this is not for naught. People will hear this, and the best thing we can do is try the best for your brother, and we have to be okay with the results. That's in God's hands, you know, what God wants to help reveal this, but at least we're doing what we can on our end. So, but they need to hear your voice. So they need to know what these families are going with, because I've known you for many years. There's stuff I found out on this podcast. You know, I didn't know about your aunt passing away that week. That was news to me.
So, oh yeah, yeah.
But all right, Jackie. So any closing words? I thought this interview went fantastic because people they're going to get to personalize this case where they maybe not have been had this chance before.
Oh well, thank you to you, Dennis, for doing this. You're very special to our family. So as the listeners just heard, you know, I reached out to you as well in 2002, and here we are 18 years later, and you've been so dedicated, you know, not just to my brother, but also to Kristen Modafferi and Kristen Smart. So, you know, we love you so much, and your family now. And I just want to say to the listeners, I'm sure Dennis at some point will introduce you to the other siblings. It's, you know, Kent was the oldest, and then myself, and then there's Kim, Keith, and Kelvin, and, you know, all gutted from this experience, but also with our own unique individual experiences on this. And, you know, we were just a happy-go-lucky family, like most, you know, families. We grew up in, you know, very modestly in this small town. It's just an inconceivable, unthinkable that here we are, you know, 18 years later, and we don't know what happened to my brother. You know, when the minutes turned to hours, turned to days, turned to weeks, turned to months, it was surreal. And I always say, and I've said this to you before, Dennis, that there's a reason that, you know, I think God doesn't let us know everything we want to know, because if you had told us the first week of March 10th, 2002, that 18 years later, we wouldn't know what happened to Kent. I don't believe any of us would have been here, and not from self-inflicted harm, just from, I mean, emotionally and mentally and psychologically. You know, I don't know that we would have had the capacity to have handled that, but, you know, we are not giving up. We are still just as dedicated and committed today as we were on March 10th, 2002. And again, we're just so thankful to you and thankful to the listeners. Thank you guys so much for taking the time out of your day to hear this story. And we hope that it resonates with your heart as well. And like I said, that anything that you can do to help us spread the word, we greatly appreciate from the bottom of our hearts.
Hey, I have a question. There's a guy named Derek Harada out in California. I was telling him about Kent and, you know, the Lumbee tribe. And he, right away, his suggestion was to reach out to the Lumbee Nation in Fayetteville. I'm assuming you guys have done that, right?
Yeah, our tribe was very supportive. You know, members of our tribe showed up for the searches. Kent's information was on their website for, gosh, Dennis, probably 10 to 12, 15 years. I think the tribe provided, you know, support in terms of, they had bike rides for fundraisers for us to make buttons and flyers. Because again, here's the thing that people don't understand is because we didn't have the support of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, every flyer, everything that we needed to do to have printed either had to come from our own resources, which we were happy to do, or from the kindness of in-kind donations from other people. Because the truth is, you guys, it takes money to find a missing person.
Absolutely.
You know, so we were very fortunate that our tribal members were supportive.
Okay. All right, Jackie, thank you so much for doing this. It went better than I anticipated. So I think people will get a sense of who you are and what your family's going through. And we have a Facebook group. It's just, you know, Facebook/Kristen and Kent. And so you can put your comments up there as well. And Jackie, thanks again. We'll be hearing from you again in future podcasts. Okay.
Thank you, Dennis. Bye-bye.